Well, as David Darling and his co-author write, and we are not alone, microbial life is abound, not only in the solar system, but beyond as well. We're going to talk with him more about that when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. What do you think jump-started this microbial life, David, throughout the universe?
You mean what do I think started life in general? What's the trigger,
yeah,
for the origin,
yeah,
of life?
The
you know, that if I could answer that, I'd have a Nobel Prize, because that is one of the unanswered questions of science, is that is the origin of life. And, you know, there are various hand-waving arguments about how it happened. You know, you know how you can get the original basic chemicals, you know, the amino acids. You can get to that stage. Amino acids are the building blocks of proteins. You kind of know how they build into proteins. But how you get from those type of, you know, promising molecules to something that's wrapped up in a cell and that you can call alive is an unknown. And I don't know, and no scientist on the planet, and no one on the planet can tell you how that happened. We simply don't know. And there is a big jump, unfortunately. It's a big gap between,
yeah,
these building blocks and something that you can say is a definite life form. It's,
mm-hmm,
a huge gap, unfortunately. And the life form has a whole lot of information wrapped up inside itself in its DNA, because it has to then make copies of itself so that, you know, it carries on to the next generation and so on. That is not an easy gap to bridge, and we're quite a way away from it at the moment. I have to be honest with you. Most scientists like to say, oh, we're going to answer that in time. Yeah, it's coming along, and maybe they will, but we don't know. I don't know.
Is it accurate to say that substances that were not alive, they were not alive, formed, and all of a sudden, that formation, they became alive?
It's... At some point, that must have happened. At some point, you've got to be able to put a label on something and say, that is now alive. Before, it was just a bunch of chemicals. Now it's alive. And I suppose it gets down to kind of having something that you can call a self, in a way, something that is able to exist independently of its environment. And to do that, there has to be something. It has to be in a bag of some kind, a membrane. It has to separate itself from whatever else is around itself. And that's kind of a big distinction. You know, how did that happen? How did the information get into that bag of chemicals that says, now make a copy of yourself, now reproduce and produce more of your kind so that you can carry on into the future? Yeah, at some point you have to be able to make that distinction. It probably happened fairly suddenly. Yeah.
Let's take out for a moment all the discussion of UFO visitations and the possibility,
uh-huh,
and things like that. Let's just,
uh-huh,
take that out of this equation for just a moment.
Uh-huh.
What do you think will happen, or do you think we will ever find intelligent life like ours? And if we do, how do you think we'll find it?
Okay, well, the thing is, it depends.
I don't make it easy on you, do
you? You don't make it easy, no. And there's a big discussion going on in astrobiology at the moment about how difficult it is to move from simple life forms like bacteria, of,
mm-hmm,
which there are a whole abundance around. They're always the most common things, even now. You know, we always think, well, you always focus on advanced life, but in fact, they're still there, of course, and they're still there in huge numbers, and they are the most successful life forms on the planet. There is a huge discussion about how easy it is to get from that single-celled stage to, you know, the sort of things that are more interesting to us as humans, that is plants and animals and, of course, ourselves, and how often that happens elsewhere on other worlds. It's a big question, and that is where I tend to take the optimistic side of things, because I see intelligence as being a driving force. I look at the way... It took a long time for advanced intelligence to come about on the Earth for one reason or another, but I suspect that it is that nature has a compulsion to try to reach intelligence. So I'm on the optimistic side of things, and you can tell that from the books I've written. I mean, going back to the previous book I wrote, it's called Life Everywhere. This one is called Why We've Already Found Extraterrestrial Life. I'm an optimist as far as astrobiology goes. I'm an optimist as far as I'm saying how often simple life becomes intelligent life. you can talk to other people and they'll say that doesn't happen very often, that maybe we're even alone in the universe. I don't believe that. I think intelligence is a driving force within nature, and I think wherever it's possible to come about, it will come about, and that we will find it out there among the stars. But it may be well beyond where we are, because we were talking before that we've only had flight for 100 years. Okay,
that's right.
So what about a civilization that is just 1,000 years ahead of where we are? They'll be doing undreamed of things. We can't even predict where we're going to be in 10 years time, let alone 100 or 1,000 or 1,000,000 years time. Most technological civilizations out there are going to be so far ahead of us, they're going to seem like gods by our standards, because we are new. We're new kids on the block as far as technology goes. So my answer to your question is, I think it's quite often that the jump to intelligence occurs quite frequently, wherever it's possible, and the most intelligent life out there is going to be way beyond where we are at the moment.
I should, but I don't know why. I'm not excited about the possibilities if they find, microscopic life.
I know what you're saying. But, you can either approach this problem from one of two directions. You can either go looking for the big game. In other words, you can be, somebody who's excited by UFOs and by pyramids on Mars, and you can start from, or if you want to get more conventional, looking for radio signals from other planets.
Yeah.
And go for that big game and go for the all or nothing type of thing, And it is an all or nothing, because if you're listening for signals from other stars, as we have been for 40-odd years now, and we've not found anything, I don't find that very exciting. If we found it, of course, it would be so exciting that you'd fall off your chair,
Yeah.
But at the other end of the game, which is kind of where I like to be, is a bottom-up guy, where you start looking for proof that there is life out there. And as we've claimed in our book, we already have that proof. I find that exciting, not because I find bacteria particularly exciting, but because if there's life out there, I believe there's all kinds of life out there. So to me, it's more exciting to get that proof that there's some kind of life than waiting forever based on, kind of far-fetched speculation. You can go over it from two directions, and both are interesting. But I like to think that there is alien life out there of any kind, and then I can build on that. That's just my approach,
What percent of scientists do you think believe that there's some kind of life, even if it might be microbes, that there's some kind of life out there?
Oh, I think it's well into the 99th percentile.
Wow.
Yeah, I think that's almost a universal assumption among scientists. And of course, you've got to say, well, scientists who know what they're talking about, because if you happen to be a mechanical engineer or a physicist, maybe your opinion isn't any better than the guy that lives next door, But if you're talking to astrobiologists or biologists who've studied the problem, most of them today would say the chances of life out there is just so high that it's almost a certainty. There's a few. And they are led by almost philosophical beliefs who would say that life may be unique to Earth. That's a very minority view. Most say now that life is probably fairly common out there. The big question, going back to what we said before, is how often that simple life becomes advanced and intelligent. That's an unknown.
How about 50, 70 years ago? What would that percentage
be? If you'd been in this science 50 to 70 years ago, you would have been scoffed at. You wouldn't have been able to make a living at it. And certainly 70 years ago, if you pretended you were an astrobiologist or an exobiologist, as it was called in those days, you wouldn't have got anybody to listen to you. They would have said, you don't know what you're talking about. It would have been like a ufologist is today. But that kind of difference. Ufology today is at the margins of science, and you couldn't get a ufology paper presented in a mainstream, conference. There's no way you would. But 50 years ago, the same situation would have applied to astrobiology. So it's changed. Astrobiology is now mainstream science. 50 years ago, it was almost at the margins of science.
Let's go back to Mars for a moment. Mm-hmm. What do you think is there in terms of life?
Well, can I talk about Viking for a moment?
Absolutely.
Because that's where it all starts. And as I said before, I believe that Viking found life, and I think that maybe not intentionally, but scientists painted the wrong picture of what happened. You know, the message was put out that Viking found nothing more than unusual active chemicals in the soil, that basically Mars was dead. And that's had a profound effect on everything that's followed, including the direction of the whole space program. So the question is, where did things go wrong? Well, back in 76, two identical spacecraft, Viking 1 and 2, landed on Mars. They both carried miniature biology labs, kind of about the size of a microwave oven. It was quite small. But they had three experiments which were looking directly for life on Mars. And they were the first spacecraft to do this. And incredibly, the only spacecraft that have ever looked for life on another planet. You know, in the 30-odd years since then, we've never sent out another probe to look for life. And that's because the mainstream science said Viking didn't find anything. So, you know, they carried out some experiments. I just want to zero in on a couple of them. One was called the label release experiment. One was called the pyrolytic release. And the agreement was beforehand, if any of these experiments found a positive signal, then we would say that they'd found life on Mars. And that was thrown out the window later on. So what the label release experiment did was it took a sample of Martian soil, it dripped some water onto it, some goodies, some nutrients, kind of like a chicken soup type of thing for bacteria. And the neat thing was that those nutrients were laced with radioactive carbon. And the hope was that any bugs in the soil would metabolize that food and they'd give off radioactive carbon dioxide, which you could then pick up with a radiation detector, a Geiger counter. And lo and behold, that's exactly what it found, a big rush of radioactive carbon dioxide, which lasted for about 3 days, exactly what you'd expect if there were bacteria in the soil, and not what you'd expect if there was a chemical reaction. It wouldn't last that long. There's no way. The other experiment, the pyrolytic release experiment, showed that organic chemicals were manufactured in the soil by something. That's kind of hard to explain without life going on. Mm-hmm. And these two together gave life signals. So why didn't scientists say that Viking had found life? Because according to the pre-agreed criteria before Viking ever left the launch pad, both of those experiments found life. The reason was there was another instrument on board Viking, which was called the GCMS. That stands for Gas Chromatograph Mass Spectrometer. And the whole purpose of that instrument was to look for organic material, anything containing carbon, basically, in the Martian soil. And that came up negative. It didn't find a single thing. It didn't find a single carbon-containing molecule in the soil. And it was used as a court of appeal, basically. So you've got two experiments saying, yeah, there's life here by pre-agreed criteria. Another instrument says there can't be life, no organics, you can't have life. But that instrument wasn't working properly. And we know it wasn't working properly. It's been demonstrated. It was demonstrated even before Viking took off, although it wasn't really well-known or advertised. But in several studies since then, identical equipment to the GCMS been tested on Antarctic soils, on soils from deserts regions on Earth, which are similar to Mars, and it has failed to find life where we know there is life by other instruments. And so this Court of Appeal instrument was faulty. We know it couldn't have detected organic material on Mars, and yet that's the way it panned out, that scientists used that as a way to say there's no life on Mars. So the GCMS found nothing. And so what did the Viking scientists team do? They dismissed the positive readings of the other two experiments. And they said that the activity in the soil was due to some kind of reactive chemical like hydrogen peroxide, and that was that.
What kind of critters, David, do you think might be on Mars today?
Well, I think there's small life in the surface. And by the way, we've got some pictures on the Coast to Coast website that maybe people would like to check out.
Yes.
And I think the most interesting ones are the ones that come from the recent Phoenix lander, which was on Mars. It's obviously still on Mars, but it was working on Mars last year and sent back a lot of useful information. The most intriguing things, and there are three pictures that I've given to put on the Coast to Coast website that people can check out now if they want to. The microscopic images of the soil, and they show three objects which are labeled A, B, and C, and you can show, you can see quite distinctly that they've moved. Nothing in the surrounding material has moved, but these three objects, which are about the size of bacteria, have clearly moved in different directions. Now, it's not wind. Wind would tend to blow everything the same way, and they're moving in different directions. Apart from fluid motion, unless there's some fluid in there which we don't know about, those things have moved of their own volition, and they look like single-celled organisms. So maybe what we're looking at there is our first glimpse of living Martians. I think there's microbial life in the surface layer of soil, probably nothing more than that. Underground, there is probably a much bigger community of life, which could even include larger organisms up to the size of worms even, or possibly even larger than that. So I think we've got a thin layer of life on the surface or just below the surface, and then deeper down we've got a bigger community of Martians. I think anything much bigger than that may have lived a long time ago and have since died out or moved elsewhere. What there is there today, I think, is fairly simple stuff.
Insect life, possibly?
Well, I did mention worms, and if you look at, actually, if people want to go into this further, if you do a Google search on unidentified moving objects, Phoenix, say, in your search, you'll get to a YouTube video where a guy has actually looked at the raw images and has produced some very, very interesting time-lapse sequences of images that appear to show something more than microbial life. Now, yeah, it is possible that deeper down there could be multicell life, up to including insect or worm-like organisms. I wouldn't find that too surprising.
Let's assume for a moment that Mars might have been inhabited with the intelligent beings like ours, maybe even more intelligent than us. I hope so. And they built structures. They had pyramids. They had an evolution. What do you think happened to them, David? They're not there now.
No, it's obvious they're not there now, unless by some miracle they're living underground. But I think we would see some evidence of that in the atmosphere. There would be right. There would be some traces of it. So one possibility is, of course, they died out, and we'll find their remains on the surface or under the surface, and that's a possibility. It seems to me that if they were building structures, if they were building something like pyramids, then they're at a similar stage in their evolution to where we are today, give or take a few thousand years, which is nothing really. And the decline of Mars from a vibrant living world, which had water and a thick atmosphere, to what we see today, which is a very inhospitable place by human standards, would have been slow. It would have taken place over millions of years. So any creature on the surface, you could imagine today, if we saw that the things, conditions on Earth were slowly changing, we'd do something about it. We're not just going to be sitting ducks waiting for it to happen. We'd build spacecraft. We would migrate somewhere else. So I would imagine if this is what had happened, it's a big if, but if it had happened, it's entirely possible that the Martians would have left their world and gone somewhere else. And we ought to find traces of that too. You know, if there was this kind of advanced technology, we ought to, in future, when we get there ourselves, be able to do the archaeology and uncover the history of what actually happened.
I believe if an astronaut goes to Mars and uncovers those kinds of relics, they would probably be in awe.
They would be absolutely flabbergasted, I should think. It would change everything. Whenever we discover traces of intelligence out there, whether it's past or present, is going to change us forever.
David, let's leave Mars when we come back and talk about more life possibly in the solar system, and then let's go beyond. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment with David Darling on Coast to Coast AM. Well, next hour will be our final hour with David Darling, and we'll take your phone calls. But when we come back, more to talk with him about fascinating work. We are not alone. David, beyond Mars, what do you think of Venus and the possibilities there?
Well, you know, Venus long ago was thought to be kind of like the Earth was in a primitive stage. And you could imagine all sorts of things because it's cloaked in a thick blanket of clouds. You can't really see the surface at all. Today, we know that Venus is a very hot place. The surface is hot enough to melt lead, even hot enough to melt zinc. So you're not going to really expect life on the surface of Venus today. But just as in the case of Mars, a long time ago, 3 billion plus years ago, it could have been a much different story. There could have been vast oceans on Venus. There could have been life on Venus. Now, the question is, if there was, what's happened to it today? In the case of Mars, we think that if there's anything on the surface, yeah, that's fine, but some of it will have gone below the surface to escape the harsh conditions. On Venus, the opposite may have happened. It may actually have gone up into the atmosphere. And that's one of the topics we cover in our book. It's an unexpected discovery, really, and a kind of an unusual possibility that Venus might have life. We tend to discount it, but we do know that particles exist in the atmosphere of Venus, which are similar in size to bacteria. It's a dense atmosphere. They could be buoyed up there for weeks on end, multiplying. You could actually have an atmospheric life there about 30 miles above the surface in what's called the lower cloud deck. It's an intriguing possibility.
Well, that is one heck of a planet. Now, beyond, though, Mars, and we go out to the farther-reaching planets out there, their moons, David, seem more interesting than the planets themselves.
I know. And that, again, is a huge surprise because traditionally you think of anything beyond Mars as being almost a frozen wasteland. There's so little heat out there that, you know, you get out to Jupiter and the temperature at the surface of anything there is going to be about minus 150 Celsius. You know, that is just so cold. It makes Antarctica look tropical by comparison. You just can't imagine any life out there at all. And yet now we know that there are underground oceans, certainly on Europa, which is one of the moons of Jupiter, possibly on a couple of other big moons of Jupiter, Callisto and Ganymede, and going further afield to the Saturn, which is more than twice the distance of Jupiter. You've got moons there as well. Titan, the big moon of Saturn,
sure,
which could have an underground ocean and could even have life on its surface. It's got a dense atmosphere. It's the only moon in the solar system known to have a thick atmosphere. It's actually thicker even than the Earth's.
And methane lakes, right?
And methane lakes. So you've got hydrocarbon lakes on the surface. You've got a drizzle of hydrocarbon coming down from this thick atmosphere. You've got organics being produced high up by interaction with the radiation from Jupiter's radiation belts. You've got a lot of interesting stuff going on the surface, and we know even actually, surprisingly, of hydrocarbon lakes on Earth. There's one in Trinidad, for instance, which supplied a lot of the asphalt on which New York was built, oddly enough. It's a very curious place. It's a sort of a big tarry pool. You can almost walk across it. It's so thick. And you would imagine there's not going to be anything alive in this thing, you know, this black syrupy asphalt. But sure enough, there are organisms living in there. We know it. In fact, my co-author on this book has actually experimented in this lake, and they've produced these extremophiles that are living in this hydrocarbon lake, very similar to what you find on Titan. So there is the possibility of life on the surface of Titan, living in these methane and ethane lakes, as well as underground on Titan as well. It's a very, very interesting place.
Are we going to explore these moons, David?
Well, yes, I think we are eventually. As you know, so much at the moment in the space program is up in the air, whether you're talking about NASA or the Europeans or other agencies. So much depends on the politics and on the budgets. But there are projects that are aimed at the moons of Jupiter and Saturn. And, you know, we're hoping within the next 10 or 15 years, sounds a long way off, but that maybe a probe will be sent out to explore the Jupiter system, especially focusing on Europa, hopefully would include a lander. There's some money going into that. It'll be a joint mission between the Europeans and and NASA. But again, it's hard to set a timescale on these things. We are looking at least 10 years out before anything can get on the launch pad. But they're very high priority as far as astrobiologists are concerned. Certainly something that we ought to be doing, for goodness sake, you know. We spend money on all kinds of things. We can surely spend a little bit on looking for other life on nearby worlds. It seems to me it'll be a very interesting subject to explore.
Do you think SETI is wasting its time sending out the radio frequencies and trying to listen for radio frequencies?
Well, it's hard to say. It's like we said before, it's an all-or-nothing affair. If we get a message tomorrow, then everything they've done is justified. If they don't, then they're whistling in the wind, basically. I think it's a long shot. I've always thought it was a long shot. I think it's something we have to do because it's kind of like a possibility we have to be able to check off and eliminate. We really need to see if it will work. But what we're expecting is that there's something out there, some creatures out there, that are roughly at the same technological level as we are. In other words, using radio waves for communication. Well, that to me seems unlikely. It seems to me that 500 years from now, we're going to find some form of communication, maybe based on quantum principles or on something else that works faster than the speed of light, that doesn't involve radio waves. So it's a long shot. I don't think it's a waste of time. I think it's just highly improbable that we're actually going to hear anything.
You know, when you look at the movie Independence Day,
yeah,
where, you know, we wake up in the morning and there are huge craft from unknown planets all over the place, you know, trying to take advantage of us poor earthlings. Is that a real possibility, David? Can that happen one day?
Well, it wouldn't surprise me at all if we were being watched. You know, simply because we are reaching that stage ourselves. We can now detect nearly Earth-like planets. Over the next few years, we're going to be announcing the discovery of Earth-like planets. That's what the Kepler mission is designed to do. Once we have identified Earth-like planets, we will be able to analyze the atmosphere of those worlds and look for signs of life, which I'd be very surprised if we didn't find. We will be able to look for subtle signs of technological life, such as pollutants in the atmosphere. And of course, if we can do that at our relatively primitive stage, then any beings out there within really thousands of light years of the Earth have been doing the same thing to us. They've been watching us.
Sure.
They've been watching the evolution of Earth. So as soon as life appeared here, as soon as we had, for example, primitive plants that began to transform the atmosphere and pour oxygen into the atmosphere, that's an immediate sign of life. So going back even millions of years, any other intelligence that has been monitoring worlds as we are today, beginning to do today, would have highlighted the Earth as something of special interest, and they would have continued to monitor us over the ages till today. We are, you know, changing our planet. We're pumping gases into the atmosphere that are very indicative of a technological civilization. They'll know we're here. And what would we do if we found another planet, say, 100 light years away, that we saw obviously had intelligent life on it? We would make every effort to find out more about it. Now, what would we do? We'd focus our telescopes on it. We might even rush to send probes out there to develop the technology to send probes across interstellar distances to survey this planet. Now, I think that's probably what's happened with us. It wouldn't surprise me at all if there were probes now orbiting in orbits around the sun that were looking very closely at the Earth. The question is, are they in some sort of cloaked mode so that we can't detect them? Now, that seems to me very likely. If you've got a very advanced civilization and it wants to watch a more primitive one like ourselves, they're going to work like anthropologists do. They don't want to change that culture. They don't want to change that race. They'll have some kind of prime directive which says, we'll watch, but we won't interfere unless there is some emergency and we feel it necessary to intervene. They're going to watch in a kind of an invisible mode, so we're not necessarily aware of their presence, but it seems to me highly likely that we are being surveyed from a distance and possibly also within the solar system as well.
What if back in the era of the 40s, when we let off the atomic bomb, would that have been a trigger for any extraterrestrial race to say, oh my, what's going on that planet?
For sure, yeah. And quite possibly because they went through the same phase themselves. It wouldn't surprise me if all civilizations go through crises like that, where they develop weapons of mass destruction, where they start to affect their environment to a dangerous level. And they're all critical points at which that civilization could end. You know, if the Cuban crisis had gone the wrong way, we might not be here today. You know,
that's
we might not be here in 100 years' time. We don't know that. Now, the question is, if somebody is watching us and they're a sort of benign intelligence and they're okay watching, but they don't want that race to die, then at some point they might intervene to say, hey, guys, this is the way you solve this problem. Or they might do it on a more subtle level by intervening without us really realizing it to change the direction of history. And it seems to me that could be a possibility as well, these kind of watchers in the galaxy that try to cultivate the development of young civilizations like ourselves. And they don't try to interact with us too much, but just when it's necessary to avoid self-destruction. I don't think they'd see us as a threat because we're so primitive. I mean, nuclear weapons to an alien race that's a million years ahead would be like pea shooters, isn't
it? It's nothing.
They're not going to be afraid of us, but they may be afraid that we will self-destroy when we've got so much potential if we can get beyond that. So you could see intervention happening at some sort of level. Yeah, for sure.
Or maybe we, you know, through atomic weaponry, maybe we could tear space and time. I don't know. Maybe that would concern them.
Well, certainly there's been that suggestion of experiments that are going on today. You know, the Large Hadron Collider, for example, has raised concerns that maybe it can
make a
black hole, or it could cause a rip in space-time, which could actually end the entire universe, you know, that we could slip into. They're at the edges of speculation, but even conventional physicists have come up with some ideas that are would suggest that we're possibly altering the course of things. And yes, when you get to that level where you're recreating energies that haven't existed since the Big Bang, since the first trillionth of a second of the universe, then they've got their own self-interest at stake, and they wouldn't want any experiment that could endanger reality as a whole to happen. And then you would obviously get intervention, either on a subtle level or on a more, you know, you've got to change or else level.
And of course, there are theories that we've been seeded by some of these ETs also, David.
Well, that too is a possibility, that we are actually the children of this sort of seeding, either very early on at a primitive level or later without us realizing it. This is a panspermia hypothesis, or a sort of directed panspermia, where intelligence has actually seeded us here. And of course, if that was the case, then you would expect life to be more similar throughout the universe, because we would reflect whoever the seeding intelligence was. We would be somehow related to them in a way. I personally think that's a little far-fetched. I'm not sure I go along with that. I suspect that life did evolve within the solar system, either here or on Mars, rather than having come from elsewhere. It's certainly a possibility. You can see how it could have happened, but I'm not sure that's actually what did take place here.
Why do we have so many different life forms on this planet? How come we don't have just 5 or 10? I mean, we have zillions of them.
Yeah. It's almost like nature experiments in various ways. To begin with, maybe life forms would have been fairly similar, although you tend to always get predators and prey. So as soon as you get a life form, you'd get some other life form that used the other one as food. So then you have two, and then you have three, and then you have competition and diversity. I think it's a question of, as conditions change, life just adapts in all sorts of different ways to fill every available niche, if you like, in the environment. Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. But it's almost like, and this is why I think that life is common throughout the universe, because it seems to evolve and adapt to suit whatever conditions are available to it. It will fill every available niche, and I think that's what's going on. I think it's just that nature finding all this diversity of environments and just finding life forms that work within that environment.
I think so too. As you were putting together with your partner, We Are Not Alone, what fascinated you the most, David, about this?
For me, the realization that there is life close by, and personally for me, I don't know whether Dirk would, my co-author, would go along with this, but the fact that once we have proof of that, and I believe we do have proof, it opens up the whole field to all sorts of life being out there, all kinds of intelligent life, and the possibility that we will communicate with it and learn so much in the future. Now, that may happen sooner than later, possibly within the next decade or two.
Possibly so.
That's what excites me about it. Yeah.
You know, the wonders of science abound. I mean, there's no question about it. Would you still go into astronomy today if you were in school?
I think I would. I mean, it's something that just captured me very early on. I mean, I think as far back as I can remember, certainly from the age of 5 or 6, my dad brought back this set of encyclopedias and, of course, covered all areas of knowledge at the time, these black and white photos, and it was the astronomy section, the reconstructions of what it looked like on the moon. Of course, this was, you know, before we sent out probes to the planets and before men landed on the moon. It was in the late 50s, really, 1960, late 50s, 60, right at the beginning of the space age. But it was just something that sparked me off. So I can't imagine. I think my brain is just set up that way. I'd probably lean more towards astrobiology than astronomy today because it's life in the universe that excites me more than dead planets. So I think maybe I'd lean more towards the biology side of it. But that's really what turns me on, you know.
You seem to include the God factor in some of your thoughts. I mean, that's what I picked up in when I was reading them.
Yeah. And I've written books. I mean, if anybody goes to my website, you'll find that I've written books other than astronomy. I've written books called Soul Search and Zen Physics, which are really more about who we are than if life is out there. They're about the nature of self and what happens to us after we die. And the nature of consciousness, which I think science has a very, very poor handle on. I think scientists just simply cannot come to grips with the nature of consciousness. They try to explain it in terms of just simple brain works, and I think there's more to it than that. I think that there is something that survives beyond death. I believe that there is an overall consciousness. I think consciousness is a basic property of the universe, just like matter and energy are. This is not a conventional scientific view, I realize. It's a fundamental, heartfelt belief that I have, that there is a consciousness to everything. There's a consciousness imbued in everything, that a stone has a certain level of consciousness, that when we die, our self, our individual consciousness opens out. It doesn't close. When the brain shuts down, it's like the brain acts like a filter, and when we die, that filter is removed. And we join with the consciousness of the universe. And if you want to call that God, I don't mind. That's just a label, you know.
I wish more scientists would think your way, David.
I hope they will. I think that over time they will come. Because science, the old word science simply means knowledge. It just simply means the search for knowledge. Simply, you know, what is the nature of things and where do I fit into it? Science has become very compartmentalized and narrowed. I think scientists need to broaden out, look a little bit further afield.
All right, well, you stay with us because David Darling, our special guest tonight, will be with us for one more hour, and we will take your phone calls right here on Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Norrie. We'll be right back.